this New York Times piece on our hero Andreas is not good. It is bad.
No, it's terrible.
It is really, really bad. And I'm like, who the hell wrote this thing? And I'm like, Kevin Roos. I don't know if you follow. I mean, I've got higher expectations for Roos's work. I got to tell you, Kevin Roos, if you're listening to this, this thing is bad. Do it. Write it again.
Can I read aloud the part that, okay, I found most?
Hold on. So are we going to the passage that absolutely set me off? I wonder if it's the same package.
It's got to be the same one. So I'll turn over.
Write it down and flip it over. Go for it. Read it aloud.
Well, I already tweeted it out. So his job involves developing a piece of open source database software known as PostgreSQL, whose details would probably bore you to tears if I could explain them correctly, which I can't.
100% brain blew up on that.
You are just a journalist. Like, it's not like we expect you to understand and explain details. Like, journalism has very little to do with the comprehension and explanation of details, as far as I understand it.
Also, if this would bore you to tears, if I could explain the details to you, which I can't. You could apply, what would you not apply that to? You could apply that to anything. It's like, The 2024 presidential election, which would bore you to tears. You understood that.
Totally. Kevin McCarthy ousted. I mean, details sound really tedious. So let's just skip to the end of this whole thing, right?
Oh, man. That is absolutely atrocious. And I hope to God you had an editor demanding that you insert that parenthetical, Kevin Roos. Because it's funny that the same thing set you off, Adam. It is irresponsible. It is saying that there's something wrong with digging into the details, and that, by the way, things that you don't understand are boring. It's like, no, they're not actually things that you think you understand are actually really interesting because you actually don't understand the details. Did you keep reading this article after? Because I have to say, when I read that. And then it got worse. I feel. Did you keep reading?
I did read the whole thing. Yes, I read the whole thing. Actually, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say multiple times because, I needed to quote parts of it back to my mom, who was the editor of her college newspaper. She had read it in print on the front page of the New York Times, and found it just shocking.
That's great. God bless your mom. So you called you up so you two could read passages aloud.
I talked to my folks about it because I thought it was a really interesting one, and because I was excited to have Andres on the show, and my dad has listened to an episode of the show, so I wanted to give the heads up that there was so much excitement coming down the pike.
Exactly. And this led to obviously discussing the story, which again is not very good. And so because the other thing, they have a twist fit for Hollywood. Tech leaders and cybersecurity researchers are hailing Mr. Freund as a hero. It's like, is the twist that they're hailing him as a hero? I mean, is the writing really this bad? Andreas, are you with us?
Yes, I am. I do not know.
Welcome. Kevin Roos thanks you for showing up with working audio, because this just was not going to end. We were just Adam and me just taking swings at this terrible New York Times piece. So I'm glad you're here.
She wasn't that bothered by it, so
that's great. Actually, that is great to hear. No, honestly, that is great to hear. I'm glad, because this is, it's big news. It is great to have you with us for what is a truly extraordinary story. Folks have likely heard aspects of the story, but there's a whole lot of depth to it. There are a bunch of interesting angles to cover. But Andreas, I wonder if you might just start with what your role is in Postgres and kind of the walk up to this, because I think your diligence here and investigating aberrant behavior is such an interesting part of the story, obviously. Describe your role with Postgres and what's your background with respect to Postgres, and what were you doing that kind of walked you up to this?
Sure. I've been working on Postgres for, I don't know, 15 years or so about, and as part over time, did more and more contributions, got more and more technically involved, or deeply technically involved, and I've a lot of work around performance, replication, scalability over the years, and a lot of, I don't know, just finding. And at some point, I became a committer in the project, and I've been at for about 10 years, I would guess. And yeah, so I've done a lot of reasonably sized pieces of work in Postgres, and probably one of the people in Postgres that works most on performance, and particularly around micro benchmarking or benchmarking and profiling and seeing what's causing scalability issues and stuff like that. So I guess that I had a good starting point for finding any issues like this.
Okay, so and let me ask you, if you don't mind, because when I actually first came to Sun years ago, I came into the Solaris performance group, which some accused of being an oxymoron, but I don't think it was. I remember I was driving to lunch with our colleague Kevin Clark, who was optimizing every aspect of his route, and he had a line to me that's like, performance is not just a job, it's a lifestyle. Andres, do you have that kind of, or do you have that kind of, is that a lifestyle for you in terms of the way you think about a system and optimizing it? What drew you to performance in particular?
And actually, no, I think. I started out doing a lot of Postgres consulting and ended up doing consulting for a bunch of bigger users of Postgres. And they had performance issues because they were like the bigger users of Postgres out there, and they hadn't necessarily optimized for very large machines. And at the time, like the number of cores were exploding, and they started to try to optimize for those kinds of use cases and learn more about how to do that. I think I started out with a lot of knowledge around any of this.
Interesting. So you, as people are hitting new levels of scale, I mean, that's a great way to discover performance problems because the system is being pushed into a new domain now, and you've got, and so what were some of the performance issues that you were hitting and resolving over the years?
So many. The first really scalability oriented work was around, because of the internal locked implementation for that it calls lightweight locks. Not actually that lightweight, so the name is a bit of a
right
moron, you know, but
it's always
like a basic reader writer mutex lock, and it didn't scale that well to many concurrent readers because there was a spin lock around the lock state, which obviously will not work if you have a lot of concurrent accesses. And that I rewrote that to be a smarter implementation and do that in a reasonably portable way. Postgres tries to be portable, so we couldn't easily rely on Futexes or anything like that.
So you were effectively doing your own synchronization primitive in shared memory, and this is to allow for, because I think what you're highlighting is a very important point, that that people think of, oh, I'm going to have like a couple of readers and only one writer, so they'll share this RW lock, at least in the, what is now the Lumos kernel, and it's like, actually, if you need to modify that state, it's a read to own on that cache line. So it's like really no different than a mutex if your old times are really short. But it sounds like you wanted to build the data structure that would allow for true concurrent sharing.
It's still like a cache line with a state. So
right.
The end, it like simple lock operations are a single X add or like atomic sub, like a lock release and stuff like that. But other than that, like there's still like operations that are just a compare exchange on that cache line. So it's not a completely, it doesn't remove like lock contention, and we definitely could do better. And like there's a few projects in the works to make the lock scale better for like many waiters at the same time and stuff like that. But it's become much less of an issue over time compared to when we didn't have the optimized locking. Since then, there have been not many other parts of performance work. I've done a lot of very execution performance improvements. And there's also, again, lots of more to do because it turns out that if you take a university project from the early 90s, to 80s, it's not necessarily written to be the fastest query executor.
Yeah, I feel that's true. The part of what great makes software systems great is I feel like it's true of many software systems. It feels like with performance, there's always more you can do. And especially as the demands of the system shift over time, it feels like it's kind of an infinite supply of interesting problems.
Yes. So, and there was also just nobody else that was really focusing on that. So I think partially I migrated to avoid and what people were caring about. So, and that allowed me to become like, learn more because I was doing it and I wasn't like stepping on somebody else's toes and so on.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, the other great thing about performance work is it is it's work that you can do totally asynchronously. You can it's just you and the system. You don't have to feel like you're, which can be really helpful. I think if you're leading a project, you're on the kind of the Postgres core team there. So is it just your habit in terms of like the actual, just to kind of walk us into this back door that you discovered, were you looking at your own work or were you working on benchmarking a release or was there someone else's work? What performance were you measuring here?
Just a patch of a colleague that in some cases improved performance, but in other cases, we knew from theoretical analysis that it would likely reduce performance a bit. We wanted to see how large that regression would be. And the regression was in like a fully cached workload. And we didn't want to make that slower because that's not that's an important workload. So I was profiling like before, after the change to see what the performance difference was. And the performance difference was very small by the time I was actually benchmarking. Like I think it was somewhere in the 1% to 2% range. So
1% to 2% really regression or 1% to 2% improvement?
Because I've seen regression.
Okay.
Regression.
And then
we need because we couldn't that patch was making IO path faster, so we couldn't potentially realistically improve the non IO path. But we wanted to make sure that the IO non IO path was not like harmed measurably. So we set on to micro optimize to make sure that we. Put it down.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. And then, so what was the nature of the work that was improving the IO path? What was it doing in particular?
A large project that a few colleagues and I have been working on over the last couple of years is to add proper asynchronous IO and direct IO support into Postgres. One part of that is to make the system aware of when you read like a table or something else that. Which order blocks are required, and so that we can do like a smart read ahead or something along those lines, and read the data into shared buffers before we are blocked waiting on that. And we haven't gotten all the necessary prerequisites into this release, but we had been working on at that point was infrastructure for like a helper that makes it very easy to. Provide all the necessary information to do smart read ahead from some reader, like some place needing all those blocks.
Okay, interesting. And that makes sense why you're really concerned about like, okay, we want to add these hooks that are going to allow us to actually be much smarter with respect to IO, but we really don't want to slow down the cached path. Like we really need, and this is where, I mean, I'm sure this is the kind of thing you're looking for where it's like, a couple of extra cache line misses. I mean, you can really easily, presumably, perturb that cached path.
It's surprising, actually, how when this number of cache line accesses was pretty much the same, like even a few cycles showed up, which somewhat surprised me because there's enough other expensive things in that path that. Wouldn't have expected it to be quite so sensitive.
Yeah, I kind of feel like my intuition over the effect of this stuff is like always wrong. When I'm convinced that it's like, you know, it's like, this has got to be a caching issue. It's like, no, it's not that at all. And then when I'm like, not even thinking about it, I'm getting my butt kicked by these kinds of things. I don't know.
I've been there.
and what are you using it to? So are you looking at kind of, I guess you're starting out with a stopwatch, not by looking at hardware performance counters as you're doing this.
Yeah. It's once you start recording performance counters, like typically, like particularly if you do it like a sampling based to the profile, like that already disturbs the profile enough that I find the timing is pretty much not useful anymore. So I started out by just running NB and seeing what the total time is, and use profiles to see what is causing that slowdown.
Okay, and so is this where you begin to see, like, wait a minute, I'm definitely seeing some aberrant activity on this. Like, where do you get kind of the first hint that something odd is going on?
In that moment, the first hint was that I was seeing like repeated runs of the benchmark have a bit of noise in it, and so like results varied a bit too much for my liking. So I was checking whether the benchmark system was actually like in an idle state or whether some background process using too much CPU. That, I looked just atop and saw occasional SSHD processes using a fair bit of CPU, and it's like, this is odd. Like,
what?
Was directly exposed to the internet, so like you would expect like the usual probing, but like that should all be rejected like very quickly. Wasn't the case.
That's super fishy. That's really fishy, even on its face.
Yeah, but also it also reminds me of, Adam, this discussion we had last week in terms of like, this is the kind of thing where you're like, hey, what's going on with those SSH processes? Like that can't be important right now. Like that's not, you wouldn't like pop up. I assume, Andres, like you would pop up and then like disappear. You're like, okay, that's not, is that related? Wait a minute. Is that related? Yeah. I mean, are you?
I mean, I don't like not understanding what's going on. So I think it's very easy to distract me with random things popping up that have performance effects, because I like, if it's like something that I understand why it's using CPU, then it's fine. But if it's like something I don't understand, it bothers me. And it wasn't like the first time I was seeing it. Like this, like the benchmarking was going on for like several hours. So, but just after a while, it's like, okay, this is something I need to look at.
Yeah, you know, Andres, Brian and I spent years and years going around giving DTrust demos, and Brian, I don't know how often you did this. My demo would just be like, what's going on right now on my box? In fact, I was giving one of those demos maybe a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago at Oxide, and I found this bizarre behavior in our VPN software where it was like waking up and forking and execing every second. So like
seems suspicious.
Yeah. It turns out actually they said it was a known bug. So
that's a known back door.
Yeah, that's right. Working as intended. But yeah, like when you start looking at the system at large, you see all kinds of weird stuff that each one of these things can merit its own incredibly deep dive.
Well, and I think it's also, I'm so impressed that you, because I feel like you see these things and you're like, okay, this is very strange behavior. And you start to dig into it and it gets kind of stranger. And like, there's a point like, okay, I've got to like go back to what I was trying to do here. I need to, and that hitting that balance of like, no, wait a minute, what is going on here? How did you, I mean, you surely must have had that moment of just like, okay, is this what I want to go investigate? And then realizing, no, wait a minute, something actually very strange is going on here.
Yeah, certainly. I think I stopped investigating and started investigating a couple times.
Right, interesting.
And I'm not sure that I would actually have investigated it if I hadn't seen some weird symptoms like a couple weeks earlier. In some automated testing of Postgres, where suddenly WallGrind was, after a few package updates, was reporting some, writes that were not permissible, like to supposedly inaccessible memory, and couldn't figure out what was going on at the time. There was definitely something right at the time, but I was traveling, so I had to stop looking, and then when I now, like, doing the benchmarking, was seeing that the profiles were showing time spent in libLZMA, which should really not have any part of this workload. An SSH login should not be in LZMA, because, like, SSHD does not use LZMA directly, and no meaningful journaling or anything, like, logging going on, so there is also no reason for, like, journal libsystemd to log anything to use compression. So that was where, like, okay, there's definitely something wrong, because I'd seen the same symbols in the Walgrind reports that I now was seeing in the profile.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's always that moment when you're debugging a problem where you're like kind of drifting around a little bit, and you know, you're trying to like think about it from first principles and answer questions and so on. But then you get something where you're just like blood in the water, where you know what I mean? Where you're just like, no, wait, what the? This is, I don't know if this is even related to what I'm investigating, but this is definitely aberrant. And it sounds like, Andres, is it reasonable to say that seeing LZMA there was like, wait a minute, that does not make sense?
Yeah, it did not make sense. And I was at first thinking it could just be, like, I don't know, the profiler doing something weird.
Totally. Or, everyone always blames the debugger. Had
corrupted bug symbols, or I don't know. But like all those didn't really seem right. And like, when I was entering with the debugger, attaching with the debugger, which was, it was just about long enough that I could script it to attach shortly after fork. And I was, would see, like, okay, this is in somewhere with a corrupted stack, or the there's no, whatever, what's the debug symbol? EH frame information to for the debugger to know where are the the stack frames. Right. Didn't make sense, and was just showing somewhere, like, a bunch of unknown things, and it would occasionally lose track of the stack at all. Like, it wouldn't know where main is anymore and stuff like that. Or not main, because it never reached main, but, like, start. And that seemed just wrong, and then I just dug in deeper and deeper, and I definitely, like, lost track a couple of times because they injected the backdoor into the release tarball. But the first time I pulled the release tarball, I actually accidentally didn't do that, but loaded the generated tar-gz or tar whatever it was that GitHub generates, and that is just like the normal source, the git checkout, and that doesn't have the problem. So I was trying to reproduce it with my own build,
at this point, like, what do you think you're trying to reproduce? Are you like, there is, I mean, you're obviously going into this thinking this is just a software, it's a very weird bug of some flavor or another, where we're pulling in this thing that we shouldn't be pulling in.
That didn't take too long to think that, oh, is there something bad going on? Because
really,
if you ever, like, I don't know, but it's very rare to see, like, actual CPU usage be, like, before you reach main. You can have that if you have, like, some... if you're linking, I don't know, to libLVM or something which is ginormous, or LibreOffice, okay, then you could perhaps expect, like, meaningful time in the dynamic linker, but that shouldn't be the case for SSHD, because, like, the libraries that it links to aren't that large, and there was no really good explanation for any of this. I thought for a while it could just be a bug in, like, I don't know, the symbol that is injected is called, I don't know, underscore get underscore CPU ID, which I think is just named to similar to some, I think it's glibc function, which is underscore underscore get CPU ID. And that should never take long. And it was very quickly visible when single stepping that it was, like, way more than just do a CPU ID computation. And then it was clear that there's something weird going on.
Okay, so you're seeing, just to kind of replay that, so you're seeing this CPU utilization, heavy CPU utilization before main. I think I would still assume that you've got an init section of some shared object that is being accidentally quadratic, as our colleague Matt Keeters.
That could totally be, but it was actually before any of the init callbacks that called.
It was before, okay.
Yes, wow. So, like, okay. I mean, that took me a while to figure out because I didn't actually know how part of ELF works.
Okay.
I set a breakpoint in libc for the point where it calls the init callbacks, and those are actually after it calls all, like, loads all the shared libraries into memory and has performed relocations, because we could have cross calls across all the shared libraries, and so you have to first perform all those relocations. This part, and the way that the backdoor injected itself was that this ifuncs are like a special kind of relocation, basically, where the target address is computed, and that was where it was, like, doing the initial start of the injection. that was what was so suspicious.
Yeah. And when you say it was taken a while before we even got to main, like how long was it taking?
It's those 500 milliseconds.
Gotcha.
Crazy.
After a while, I figured out that
before that main. Is crazy.
It got a lot easier after I figured out that I could reproduce this without a running SSHD.
Yeah, interesting.
At some point, I forked my investigation to see why I couldn't reproduce a problem or quote unquote problem in running SSHD from a console. Then everything was normal. Only when I started starting it with from systemd, the problem was that was also clearly suspicious.
Okay, so I was going to ask. So it was like, when is that kind of first moment of like, I think I'm seeing something nefarious here versus something that's just very odd and just a very strange bug? Was it when you were running it differently? Or I mean, when is that kind of that? Because that must have been a wild moment.
I don't think
there
was a single moment. That's, yeah, interesting. It was like gradually increasing. To be honest, like there's also some aspect of like, after that, once I figured that out, that it was nefarious, like such a whirlwind, I kind of don't have the timing.
Oh,
down anymore. Like, because
absolutely. Time would stand still. At that point, once you are like, I am looking at a backdoor, I can only imagine that you would not, you would be so locked in at that point that, how many, like, what is the timeline here from first starting to experiment with this patch and benchmark it to, wait a minute, they've got this extra CPU utilization. I mean, like, I can imagine that happening over days or weeks or maybe hours, but it feels like this is over a slightly longer period of time.
Yeah, so the first time I saw, like, those wall grind errors, that was, like, about a month before I looked at the CPU utilization. Yeah. And I had kind of forgotten about that. And even like the first minute or like half an hour of looking into the CPU utilization, I was like, this all looks very familiar in some way, but I couldn't actually remember what, even though it was only like a month. But after a while, like it came back and luckily I had like a shell history of what I had looked at. And
saved by the show history. God, so many times I've been my butt's been pulled out of the fire by my own show history. Thank you, past Brian. You interesting. So okay, so you
see, and I think it was a couple hours of investigation that I was sure that something was weird. I wasn't yet sure where that problem was, like that it was like actually in LZMA, that it was or any of that was not at all clear. And from like figuring out that there was something weird to the report that was a few days.
That must have been some pretty extraordinary days, I would imagine. It's pretty focused days. I don't know if you have, this is where, I understand that my kids tell me that if you die in your house, your cats will eat you within a matter of days. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've never exactly looked at the cats the same way. Again, Andres, I don't know if you live alone or with pets or anything, but it just feels like you'd be like so locked in once you are realizing like I am on the path of something that's really big. I mean, and extraordinary.
I try to have like a few days a week where I don't have any meetings. Yeah, I think the first day I looked into it, I was looking in a no meeting day. And so like I spent most of that day. And then the next day is like was a meeting day. So I remember sitting in a bunch of meetings and like not really being able to concentrate because it feels I need to continue looking into this. Also, at this point.
Yeah, I have this open can of plutonium in my kitchen that really I should be attending to.
Yeah, exactly. I need to actually save humanity over here. But no, this sounds like the state we have for the coming month, it sounds important. Wow. So, you're 500 milliseconds also should be said. This is an extraordinarily long amount of, and this is like 500 milliseconds of compute time, it sounds like.
Yeah, that was like nearly completely CPU bound.
CPU bound.
There was a bit of were a few cache line misses, but like it was like nearly all like just number of instructions. I don't remember the exact APC. Like it was like clearly bound by like the number of instructions, nothing else. And, like, the reason that it was actually this expensive is that it's all like due to obfuscation, not because it was doing expensive crypto or anything. They want to remove the irony. There's no strings visible in the binary in that injected object file. And instead, they have some weird obfuscated try of like various strings. And string comparisons, it walks basically, and this is like where I am starting to not really understand. So this is like largely from other people looking into it after I publicized the report. Matches like this, the symbol names via these obfuscated strings. And that turns out to be really expensive the way they implemented it. And they do that for every symbol in the, like, I don't know, the various shared libraries that are loaded. And that's where all the time is spent.
That's where.
And that if they had done less obfuscation, I probably would not have noticed that anything was wrong, because like a few hundred, like if microseconds, I wouldn't have been able to notice.
Yeah, anything. That's it. I mean, I think that, like, again, if you know, I think for software engineers, like, you basically know this, but for Kevin Roos, for whom the details are apparently too boring, that's an extraordinary amount of CPU time, and you almost certainly have something that is either compute intensive, like crypto or what have you, or you got something that is just iterating over a lot of data. And it sounds like that's, in this case, it's like going over every symbol to obfuscate it, doing like an expensive string comparison. It's like, yeah, that is gonna add up if you have a lot of symbols.
Yes, and like it's not even that there are that crazy amount of symbols, and like. SSHD compared to, I don't know, some ledger, maybe, but like this string matching routine takes a few good cycles for each individual character. Like, it does add up.
So at what point do you, so you're like, this is something nefarious. I don't know what it's doing. And where do you kind of turn that dial of like, hey, I need to, it is time to let other people know about this versus like, I need to check my own work. I mean, that must have been a balance in there as well. Like, this is serious, and I need to like make security teams aware of this. What was that kind of inner dialogue like?
I think I was trying to, like, initially I was wondering whether I should report it just at that stage. It was all unclear where the problem was coming from. That I felt like I didn't know where exactly to report to and who to let know.
Yeah, interesting.
So I waited until, like, I wanted to understand the, is this the source of the problem? And at some point I figured out that it was like LZ or XZ, I guess. And initially I thought it was the Debian package maintainer that was where the source of all of this was from. Like, it was visible in the Debian package sources, like the injected text thing. It wasn't visible in like the downloaded or in the Git checkout. So I figured that out, I was like, okay, I'm going to report this to Debian.
Right. Yeah, right.
Because they must have built it wrong, because when you build it from source, it's all fine.
I mean, I was seeing that there was something malicious in the tarball or in the Debian sources. Like, I was seeing that it was executing this weird thing.
So your thinking is like a Debian build server has been rooted, or their build process has been somehow corrupted. Is that kind of what you're thinking at that time?
It was in the, like, they have a Git repo for the maintainer of XZ. So, and it was visible in that Git checkout because they import the tarballs. So it was clear that it wasn't just the build process. It was like either the maintainer committed something intentionally malicious, or they didn't notice, or the system was hacked. And then, so I started writing up a report just to Debian. So I thought, like, I will need to let them know that something is going on. And then at some point I figured out, this is not actually Debian specific. This happens, or it's not in the Debian package alone. It's in the upstream tarball. And I think as soon as I knew, had realized that, I reported it. And while people were working on coordinating, what to do about it, I was like doing more investigation of what was happening. And at the initial report, I didn't yet know that it was redirecting any symbols or any of that. That was coming later.
Oh, interesting. And So then when do you start to, because at some point, you start to think that AutoTools, that LibTool is to blame. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, there was a weird thing that way they inject themselves into the build processes that they just add a few lines before the main invocation that triggers like building the library via LibTool. And they basically just adding something before a semicolon, and so it gets executed. And that then recursively triggers LibTool again, because like part of the commands that it has, like gets via environment variables, is like the normal LibTool invocation that would also happen during an backdoored build process. And that ends up like rebuilding the same file, like the same sum of the files multiple times. It was like confusing me because it did not normally happen. And the way the output was that they added like, where in some parts of the build they were like make, what's the add at the beginning of a make rule, so it wasn't printing it out. So I didn't even see that it was doing it twice. I was seeing like GCC invocations for the same file with different PIDs. I was very confused for a while because it was. I haven't been able to figure out how to properly make actually also output the silenced rules. Turns out that it prints more if you do make dash n. And that happened to show the problem. And there, and I at some point figured out that it was like double invocation of the tool rule coming from somewhere. And yeah, that then made me realize that what the modified part of the makefile was.
And I mean, there are consuming 500 milliseconds in their auditing code. Like, I'm not sure how clever that is. This part of it feels really particularly clever. I'm not sure. Is that a fair read on it? Or they've taken effectively, as I understand it, they have taken one of the, like the corrupt data that they have to test it, and then they've perturbed that and then used that as the payload.
And the code to do that is not actually in the Git sources. That's just in the release tarball. So if you just look at either the release tarball or the Git sources, their own, you can't actually figure any of it out. The modification to the build system, it looks plausible-ish. If you just are used to looking at autoconf loop or M4, like it's just like weird M4 keys, and only the test file really shows the problem. And
but it felt pretty. As Brian was saying, the test data, it's all this weird fixture data that doesn't look like anything anyway. So it is just the perfect place to bury this kind of stuff.
One more thing that made me really suspicious relatively early on was that I was seeing that in 5.6.0, they added those test files, but there was not actually a test using them.
Oh, interesting.
It felt like a weird giveaway. Like, I don't understand what. Like, they added the test that actually uses those files, but only in 5.6.1.
Whoops.
I was like, why would you add test files 20 hours before the EU release and then only add a user after the release? That's off.
That is off.
I think they must have been like hurried because of the removal, like upstream systemd was removing the dependency on LZMA at built at like every load time. They were going to dynamically load the shared library only when they needed it, and they wouldn't have needed it in this context. And it would have been much harder to do any redirection if you during DL open. So I think they very hurriedly started to release it and do the injection. I think they were not prepared to go live at that point.
So
this is a really interesting part of the story, because this endeavor, and we'll link some timelines in the notes, but this endeavor had been going on for multiple years. So then to see that, you know, both things were coming to fruition and there was this closing window, as you're saying, Andres, of systemd changing, this PR being merged and the opportunity being missed. I mean, seems like tough deadlines over in the state-sponsored exploit land.
Saints Hunter next point land. It's like, oh god, is schedule over quality again around here?
I also think that the backdoor works. There's a lot of really well done work. At the same time, it has like this, it's using the same, like the really good obfuscation techniques. It's using way too, using it for too many things that where it actually isn't required.
Interesting.
And if it feels to me like somebody developed like a lot of the techniques to, hey, how can you redirect something during shared library load time where you can redirect symbols because later the memory for global offset table is mapped read only, so you can't actually redirect anything anymore without like mprotect or something, and that an mprotect from coming from some injector code, that's pretty suspicious. So wanted to do it at that time, but like that required lots of weird complicated hangups because during the ifunc execution you can't actually do any function calls. It's like none of the relocations haven't yet been performed completely, so you can't do easily call like a libc function or anything like that.
Right.
And because of that, they needed to do like lots of complicated stuff. And
interesting,
if they had just done the minimum part, I think it would have been fine, because like that would have added like tens perhaps of milliseconds. But then they added more, looked more and more symbols up. And like there's a list of like somebody wrote like a obfuscated list of strings, and like the list of symbols it looks up at that time is very large. But there was actually no need to do that. They could have just some heuristic during connect, like sh connect time after they injected the backdoor, and done more of the library initialization at that time, more of the symbol lookups, all the symbols they only needed to call themselves, and whole overhead would have been gone, and been present. And kind of feels like there was just some less experienced people using the techniques that other people built for them and then overused them further. And it has a bit of a corporate project feel to it at times.
It's like,
just going through the motions of like, I got to use Bob's obfuscation tool because he's so proud of it. Now he's the VP of these exploits and just got to do it his way, I guess.
You know, I've said around that this nation state, we need more mentoring. We need a better mentoring program, and just no one wants to listen to me. It's always, got to get this thing out today because they're closing the door.
But can we be a little more agile, folks? Well, like, what's with the waterfall schedule here?
Well, if you're not the one making the timing, but like the projects control the timing, it's a bit harder to plan any.
And so you think so this backdoor, because it was clearly important to them to backdoor SSH in particular, that this all was a very a long chain to get through to SSH, and I mean pretty creatively to get to SSH through a library that it does not link to. I mean, that is not the first
thing. They must have had a lot of, like, somebody on the team must have had like a lot of Unix experience or multiple people, because like stuff they know about weird autoconf build issues and how to like plausibly, and they like had like weird comments in the eject like added code to build to host M4 that sounded like reasonable ish, like as good a justification as I've read in many other parts of autoconf. And that's not to say it's good, but just like it sounded like plausible. And then like knowing about weird the way the injection works, you needed to know about ifunks, and then that was not actually enough to do anything because like it happens that the ifunk invocation happens just when the LDMA is loaded, but not when the main binary is not yet loaded, so you can't redirect anything for that. So they needed to know about the audit hook mechanism, which is like itself like a copy from Solaris, I don't actually remember. Like
it is,
old.
It is 100%. No, it is. When I saw that, I'm like, oh no, I'm so sorry. Because there was that is the plit auditing that Rod and Mike added, and Rod.
These are colleagues of ours, from the colleagues. Solaris team. Yeah.
And there was kind of an era. Actually, honestly, I appreciate it because there was an era. Well, because this is not true for all Linux facilities. I kind of wish that more Linux facilities would literally like just look at people that came before them. And like, and the GNU linker was happy to be like, no, like we are Solaris linker is basically state of the art. So we're just going to implement everything they've got, which I think was a good approach because there's a lot of good stuff that they did. And then we've got Plit auditing, which I actually think is, I don't think is bad. Actually, it's kind of, they had, and like, I mean, because Adam Sotras, I think, used Plit auditing, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember that? I remember Sotras, but I don't remember the specific mechanism there. But
yeah, it was kind of a slightly different idea about how you might debug a system. And I mean, not that Detroit's put it out of business, but it definitely made it, it took away a use case because they were kind of thinking of a debugging use case. And Mike, if memory serves, had built this thing called Sotras, a shared object trust being the kind of the old trace Unix kind of, the S trace but using proper Roger Faulkner's trace system calls and signals is kind of where trust comes from, but the so that was kind of, but yeah, I think you're right, Andre. So I think that this was coming from GNU LD, I think, took this from Solaris. So I was like, oh no, I'm sorry.
I think it might have made more sense back in the Solaris days, but number of symbols are actually so large these days and very common use cases that amount of information it gives you, unless you add like a lot of filtering, is just kind of too large. And
yeah,
so not something that a lot of people still need to look at. And the intrusion vector it provides seems like problematic to me. And I'm, I haven't actually seen any, like a lot of other, try to look whether there's other or backdoors or exploits or whatever using deal audit, but I didn't find much. But I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more because it seems like kind of made to defeat like a lot of the security mechanisms that were introduced to make some exploitation harder.
Yeah, and it also like it also, I mean, I can see, you know, the kind of the genesis of the facility and why they've got it. We definitely used it. I've used it for things where you are able to, because you're able to interpose on using a mechanism that isn't just LD preload. The problem is you're also like allowing people to kind of monkey patch programs, and you're not necessarily encouraging best software sharing. So you discover this thing is using and you now kind of know that this is coming from upstream in XZ, which is super surprising. Do you at this point realize that like there's actually a crooked committer here? When does that kind of light go on?
I think that was as soon as I discovered it was coming from upstream.
Yeah, oh, interesting.
I found that it referenced those test files. So I looked at who added the test files. At that point, it was pretty clear that like, either the system was hijacked or that they were involved.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and it seemed suspicious enough that kind of was leaning towards them being involved in some way, because it's not just a single day, it was multiple days. I hadn't yet like found the, like looking later, I found that frame where they did weird things was a lot larger, but like I hadn't, I said at that point, but it was clear that they were involved, so we couldn't I couldn't really port it to the C security contact, which was GIA at that point. Because that was clearly not going to be helpful for anybody. It was just going to like tell them that, hey, you got all the machines that you can find in a scan now. We better exploit them right now.
Right. Wow. Okay, because you know that didn't really occur to me, but of course that makes sense that the security contact for the library is GIA. And fortunately, you know enough to realize, like, I don't know if this person even exists, but this person is definitely involved in the nefarious activity. So I'm not going to, because normally the responsible protocol would be to obviously get the security folks involved for a particular project. And now are you at this point working with Red Hat or Debian? I mean, Debian engineers, I mean, who's kind of, has a team kind of grown at this point working on this, or are you still doing it while you're in meetings?
I'm not entirely sure what the exact precise timeline was because I was, ported it up like to various security lists that are like private security lists, and then continued, as soon as I had sent those emails, I continued investigating and then just back and forth discussions. So I don't, exact timeline there is a bit hard to.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
together, sure. But I think I did like until the release of the public email. I did had most done most of the technical investigation of what's happening. I got to the point of like figuring out that it was detouring RSA public decrypt.
Yeah. Wow. So I mean, at this point, I mean, and maybe in. Presumably earlier, you've realized like this is a very big find. This is a very, very, very big story, a very big vulnerability. I mean, at this point, are you thinking like I'm definitely dealing? I mean, I guess we don't know for certain that this is a state actor, but I think the consensus is that it is likely someone who is doing this for their job. They're doing it over some number of years. It feels like it's an intelligence agency. I mean, are you?
I don't think I got any of that part. I saw that I didn't. Analyze what was happening upstream that carefully or anything. I was just seeing that there were those changes and were introduced by one of the maintainers, and I didn't see at that point much need to look into anything further than that, because either it was like their system being compromised or them playing a long con, or I don't know. It didn't really play a role for the reaction. So I pressed forward towards like, getting all the necessary information to actually be able to make a public closure of what's happening.
And so now the timeline really goes very, very quickly, because you send that mail it's more or less public when you, I mean, it seems like the latency between you sending the mail to OSS security, maybe or maybe that is, at that moment, it is public effectively.
That's a public list.
Public list. Okay, so at that point, when it goes to OSS security, that is the public announcement of this thing. And so this was not something that had been going on, though, for months behind the scenes. I mean, you are...
No. We're talking about a few days in total.
Yeah, a few days, yeah. Well, this is important because I think that like one of the things that was surprising, certainly to those, as I talked about before, but in terms of Spectre and Meltdown, is that Spectre and Meltdown had been going on for an extended period of time. In an extremely small number of people before they kind of broaden that out. But this is not that. This is really moving quickly.
I think that's a very different situation, because like one is the backdoor. So somebody clearly intentionally introduced it and knew how to utilize it because they built it. Whereas with the Spectre Meltdown stuff, it was like researchers finding something very complicated where the real exposure of like how to exfiltrate data was like really complicated. A lot of noise associated with it. So I think it's a lot more defensible to take a long time.
Oh, no, for sure.
I don't think that year, like the time frame that it was taking it was good, but like, I think the trade-offs are very different than from something that might actually be being exploited today.
It's a very, very good point in that when you're finding like a potential vulnerability that like, oh, this is a theoretical vulnerability. There's not a known exploit in the wild. This wasn't nefarious. And what we really want to do is... we want to be sure that everyone has the opportunity to secure their systems, and that you want to be, if anything, you want to proceed kind of as slowly as you reasonably can without divulging the vulnerability such that someone nefarious could take advantage of it. And this is really the exact opposite. It's like, the nefarious thing has already happened. The backdoor is there. We really need to be biased towards getting this thing public very, very quickly. And
to fix this much easier, right? Spectre Meltdown case, like you needed to build very complicated compiler and system mitigations. Here you just needed to like go back to an already released version of a library. It wasn't, I think like the trade-offs really were kind of clear. And it's worth noting that some people were kind of unhappy even with like the very short disclosure, private to public disclosure window. Because they were saying, I kind of understand that that once it's a backdoor that is in actual use, like holding back just gives like the attacker more chances and everyone like less.
Yeah.
Well, to have a chance to defend themselves.
Especially the nature of this, where my understanding is that it was attackers with a particular private key. So this was not like opening the floodgates to anyone who knew the secret combination or whatever.
Nobody knew this at this time. It was
gotcha.
about 4 days later or something, till anybody got to that point. Because I think I was like really the only one early on to look at what it was doing, and it was taking all my skills to figure out that it was redirecting like one symbol. I'm not gonna be able to like reverse engineer some obfuscated code. Reasonably well done. Like that's just way outside of my skill set. And like it also was just not necessary. Like once you know that like it's in the path of a normal authentication, it doesn't really matter what the technical details of the quotations are.
That's right.
Like,
that's enough.
I was very worried that it was like usable for everyone, and because it actually weighed towards like not immediately, like a small disclosure window to give the distributions a chance to have a packet ready, because I didn't know that whether like everybody, like some other bad people, could quickly figure out what it was doing and then just exploit everyone.
And what is your kind of emotional state during this time? Because you got to be like a combination of, I mean, it's obviously excitement. You discovered something really important, really big, maybe a little bit of like, God, were you a little bit of fear for the damage that could be done using this? I mean, what are you kind of thinking in the kind of the moments leading up to the public disclosure?
It has changed a lot over the time. And it was really being annoyed. I didn't actually like. I was like, didn't want to spend time on this.
Yeah, but it was clear that
once I started seeing that was what it was, like there was no way I could like responsibly say like, hey, okay, I'm just going to defer this for 10 days or something. Right. That was like, wasn't a responsible option to pick. But it was like partially was really impatient to get this over with, and the other one was like, I don't know, really nervousness, like. What is the right move?
Right. Yeah.
And some of like panic giggling. I don't know.
That's great.
And did you like seek? I mean, I don't even know. Did you seek counsel from someone in terms of like what should I do? I mean, I guess it's like, I mean, the path towards public disclosure does feel pretty clear. Did it feel clear, actually? Did it feel clear that, like, what I need to do is disclose this as broadly as possible, as quickly as possible?
I think there's some minutiae I don't quite want to talk about.
Sure.
It felt very clear that it needed to go out very broad.
Yeah, that's quickly. Fair. Yeah.
The mechanics of that, I was, like, wildly unsure about.
Interesting.
Because who do you inform? Like at that point, I hadn't even figured out that it was just Linux. Was it like in all the BSDs? Was it
in a Lumos? Come on, that's not your next question. I mean, like, what about us over here? You don't know.
There's so much pain associated for me with a Lumos that I kind of don't care.
It's fine. We're used to it. It's fine.
We built some problems that we occasionally, or like, the emulated system calls occasionally fail and stuff like that Postgres. Fine. That's mostly my angle or contact.
It's fine. Look, Lumos is the latchkey kid of operating systems. Like, we'll look after ourselves. We'll let ourselves in. We're fine. We're good. We're going to make ourselves dinner. We're used to it. Our parents haven't been here for weeks. It's fine. So you don't know, but it's, and I, God, I mean, if you, you actually must have a legit, like, God, if OpenBSD is vulnerable, that is actually, would be a bit scary, honestly.
I don't remember when exactly it was. At some point, it was became clear that the path was via systemd. So that at some point used it to Linuxes. Although, like, I didn't know whether there was some other dependency on ZMA. Like, I don't know. It could have been patched in pulled in some other way.
Yeah.
Too. So I didn't. I didn't want to wait till I knew all those details to report, but between the private and the public disclosure, that was enough time to figure out that there was this if Linux Andres that actually did something. Initially, when I did the private report, I hadn't even figured out that that same script is called twice, and that's why it has like an if that's test for, I don't know, presence of some files, and then in that branch there's like Linux conditions, but then in the one that builds the injects the backdoor, there's no test conditions. I hadn't figured any of that out initially.
Yeah, wow. All right, so then now increasing confidence, okay, this is Linux, and it's publicly disclosed, and I mean you must know, like, this is going to be a big deal. How has the reaction met in terms of your expectations of what you thought the reaction would be?
I mean, didn't quite match it. Kind of thought the initial reaction would be faster, it would be noisier in the first couple hours, and that it would be way less noisy after the first few days. But like, it got noisier and noisier and noisier over time. Like, I never expected it to reach, like, you know, media audiences or anything like that. I was kind of thinking, okay, there'll be an LWN post and some security websites will list it and stuff like that, but I didn't think that general media would write about it and that.
Right, interesting. And of course, part of the reason that people are writing about it is because it's tacking into a bunch of different bigger narratives. It's certainly tacking into a narrative around open source and in a lot of different angles, how we maintain those projects. Adam, the sock puppet bullying that was happening. And because Andres, all that I assume you all discovered along with us after the disclosure. I assume that you didn't see any of that before you disclosed it. What was your reaction to seeing some of that?
Well, pretty cool in a way. Well, not just in a way. And I already suspected that when I made the report that original maintainer might not be involved.
Yeah, interesting.
And like, I think that I saw that, like, okay, now I understand the path of how that Jira actor, like, was involved and got all those, became a maintainer reasonably quickly. It was, like, explained by that. And it felt, like, really bad to be part of something that kind of have caused a lot of hurt for Lassie. And it felt like, been a maintainer for a long time now, and I know the feeling of, like, you're overwhelmed, you can't keep up, and people are, fighting you for, like, not doing enough in their eyes, not jumping through all the hoops that they want you to, and felt very familiar in a way. Like, even though, like, I don't think any of people that have been messing me out have been, like really big organized attacks, but still felt like familiar.
In super dark, as you're saying, just in terms of for whatever reason, Adam, I mean, you just felt the same way, the engagement of these sock puppets, and where they're doing good cop, bad cop with the sock puppets.
Totally.
They've invented Jigar Kumar as this just like absolute asshole who.
But totally believable character, by the way. Like,
oh, yeah. It's,
totally I've someone seen many of them. You would. I mean, I've encountered that kind of person in, the issues in PRs, dozens of times, right? So you, at no point are you raising red flags of like, wow, this person seems over the top. You're like, this person seems over the top in a normal kind of way.
Yeah, you got to wonder that, like, inside of the nation state brainstorming session, they're like, isn't the one a little over the top? They're like, no, trust me, this one is not. Sadly, you'd think so. You'd think this would be over the top, but this one is not even going to move the needle. Now, there are people like this.
Really? You're saying this person is yelling at this person who's not getting paid for their work, and that is the norm? It's like, yeah, pretty much. Yeah, no, this will fly.
Well, and also, like,
pressing way less nice interactions.
You're saying you're right. You're giving a lot of good notes, but one of them is too respectful. Okay, good.
Right, exactly. This is too respectful to be plausible.
I wouldn't quite say that, but like, I've seen people behave worse, and like
you behave worse
with like long-term email addresses and stuff, like just fake identities.
Well, you know, if one outcome that comes out of this is that, like, people are a little less inclined to be an asshole because they may be, people may assume that they're a nation state actor, like, that would be a good outcome. If, like, actually, you know, hey, why are you pressuring me to get this release out so badly on, and because the emails were, they're also, like, devoid of technical content. He's just like, hey, like, integrate these patches. It's like, well, what are we talking about here? Like, what are we, make it more concrete. Like, there's not a... It felt very manipulative, and obviously it was very manipulative.
And you can see them latch in, like the moment Lasse says, you know, I'm having these long-term mental health issues, almost immediately the pressure campaign ramps up. Yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder, like, how many more irons are in the fire, right? How many other, because like, you know, XZ can't be the only, you know, that's not a full-time job for this team, I assume. Right, like, how many other irons in the fire are they waiting? Are they kind of gently putting pressure and then waiting to see where softness emerges or where cracks emerge?
Absolutely. I mean, Andres, you must have had the same thought of, like, this can't be the only one out there like this. There's got to be some other activity out there that is. I mean, did you have that same thought?
I think seems like big enough effort that you wouldn't try to find your way into only one project. So clearly, at the beginning, they must have, like, had multiple "let's become a maintainer" type efforts.
Yeah,
I don't know whether after doing that, like, after getting access on XE, then they said, like, okay, we've achieved our goal, because once you have backdoored SSH, like, that's a don't really need much many other backdoors at the same time, and particularly not from the same team. So could it have been that they just stopped the other efforts and. Like, I think if they stop the other efforts, like, I'm not sure that realistic to ever find that out, because, like, there are enough other people that are being assholes online. Like, how would you detect that, right? Okay, right. Like, some start. Being very unfriendly that has no email identity, that can't be a smaller pool. So
right.
I don't know whether they got the concurrent efforts, but it's certainly something to be afraid of.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that, like, it's only small projects that are at risk here. Like, it was one of the early themes, like, in the online reaction to all of this, that there's so many products that are just a single maintainer or quarter maintainer or something. Like, it's not that hard to become a committer in some big projects either. And if you look at, I don't know, complex projects are in important parts of the chain, like building an open source OS, like injecting yourself into a compiler or something, like,
yeah,
or traditional horrors are made of, right?
Or libtool, honestly. I mean, I'm mocking right now, but, like, that would be, because it's something that's kind of convoluted and scary and unloved and has a bunch of architectural issues. I mean, it just feels like, boy, you could do a lot of damage by infiltrating some of these things. And so you were surprised, I guess, as we all were, about, like, the story. Were you surprised as, like, the story kept getting kind of deeper and deeper? I think still, like, Adam, I didn't realize the private key business that they've, they've discovered that there's a single private key that can basically gain access to compromised systems.
Yes, that took like 3-4 days or something.
Wow.
Investigation that somebody found that there's, like, some elliptic curve key that can be appended, I guess, to an RSA certificate, and that is how, like, their backdoor decides, hey, I'm going to do the backdoor path or the normal path. And kind of grossness of it all, like, you send an RSA public key certificate, then somehow contains in, like, some data elliptic curve key that then actually another set of payload, like, actually contains the commands. There's, like, a lot of investigation of how all of this stuff works in SSHD, and it's, like, a bit tricky.
Yeah, and then obviously another narrative that people were tacking into, I mean, whatever you previously thought about open source, this confirmed your view of it. It's kind of what I mean.
It's a very common online discourse thing, I think.
Yeah, right. Just felt like there were people who were just like, thank God it was open, which I think is my own personal bias is like, no, it's actually the openness here was a huge win. I think it also, I mean, Andres, I'd love to get your take on this, but I think the fact that it's all open required this attack to be way more sophisticated. I mean, like, my read on this is there was a lot of mental energy spent on making the repo not match the artifact, and it would be a lot easier to do that if that were not open. I mean, the fact that that repo is open requires you to spend a lot of energy on that, and that obfuscation then maybe leads to the CPU footprint that you see. I don't know, Andres, what do you kind of make of that?
I don't think the way they injected the build into the build like had any impact on the runtime overhead.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It was really the backdoor code purely itself. They just needed a way from libLDMA to SSHD, and that was where was the source of the challenge.
Yeah.
I think they could have actually committed it to the repo and nobody would have noticed, to be honest.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you look at the file, you're like, you're looking for a stray period here.
I don't think that actually played any role in the main path to exploitation. I'm kind of actually confused why they did any of that. Kind of feels like it's noisy, but not really useful. Because they can actually make the whole authentication path, like, legitimately allow access. So all the sandboxing is not very interesting. Because they can break out of the sandbox by just permitting access. I'm not sure that there's a good explanation yet why they tried that, and whether that perhaps was just parallel paths towards exploitation. They didn't yet know how to utilize LDMA access to further end. That's why they tried to inject it. Like to break out of the sandbox, because it's actually not that easy to figure out how you can get to the RSA function checking part without having passed some other checks first. It only happens in the SSL certificate based, SSH certificate based authentication, which is not like the most common way of doing it, because in the normal key based authentication, like SSH first checks whether key is in authorized hosts. So you could totally provide a fake key at that point, but you would need to know which the keys are in authorized keys. And that would have been much less attractive, obviously. And the way that what they figured out at some point is that you can do pass all of that with the certificate-based authentication. Suspect that they just figured that out later or concurrently.
Interesting. And so you think that some of the sandboxing is kind of like some tech debt they didn't bother to pay down. It's like, oh yeah, that was an old project that didn't go anywhere.
I don't know. It just confuses me. I don't think we know yet.
And so it was only 10 days ago. I'm sure this has been a rather intense 10 days for you. And of course, you're trying to get a release out as well. Congratulations on that. Did the release go out, by the way? Did you get the release out there?
I mean, it's the feature freeze. The release will be a couple of months.
Okay. But so you're scrambling.
Got some stuff in, but not quite all that I wanted. It turns out that it's fairly distracting.
Were you expecting kind of, see, the kind of the noise after the fact, or the fact that it kept growing was surprising to you. I did think it was great that, I mean, Satya had the, you know, your boss's boss, how many levels up, the CEO of Microsoft.
Exactly.
Right?
Something like that.
15, 25, however many. That must have felt good, though, to see that, and I love the fact that in particular praised your craftsmanship and curiosity, which felt like it was awfully accurate. I'm not sure. Or wait a minute, did you have to write that tweet for yourself?
I didn't know anything about it. I only learned about it a couple hours later. So I hadn't actually checked Twitter in that moment. And like, I think somebody sent it to me as a picture, and that's how I realized it. Not really. Yeah. I think I was already, like, I don't know, overwhelmed a bit, like, overstimulated, I guess.
Right.
So it's like, oh, what is happening? No. But, yeah, it was also, like, it was nice to see that it also, like, feel that working in open source teams at Microsoft, getting that recognition is just like something I couldn't have imagined 15, yeah. 20 years ago. That's a very interesting feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, that you have a company that had actually kind of explicitly under the Ballmer era had pretty much positioned itself as diametrically opposed to open source. And now that, you know, 20 years later, as you say, not only are implicitly supporting this effort because they're employing you and part of your job is working on the Postgres core team, but then to see them really being explicitly encouraging it. I mean, I assume the reaction of Microsoft has mirrored Satya's reaction and people have been pretty positive. Is that a fair guess?
Yeah, overwhelmingly. Some confusion about it exists, but I think overwhelmingly, like kind of hearing from lots of parts of Microsoft I've never had contact with, because I've been doing open source stuff at Microsoft. Like, our team has grown over the time, but like it's still like an odd corner, I guess. And like suddenly I was hearing from parts of Microsoft that I never knew even existed.
Well, hopefully there are parts of Microsoft that you need things out of, because that's the, oh, hey, look, oh, thanks. Thank you for the high praise for my work. You know, there's an email that I sent you 2 months ago that you've been sitting on. So if you could actually please, now's the time, Andres. This is the opportunity. Your window is open to get the things that you, that's great to hear. I mean, it's always, I think, because I think, you know, people rightfully feel, and they should feel proud of your role and Microsoft's role in this, because I think it's really important. One question I've got for you is the because I think this is something that people are definitely curious about, is it feels lucky. And my reaction is, this is like, well, I'm not sure this is luck so much as it is someone who's really digging into aberrant behavior. What's your kind of view? But I guess you had this kind of, the fact that you had the Valgrind artifacts, and there were, obviously it feels like you could have easily not as investigated as deeply. What is your view of kind of the role of luck in this? And I think a question a lot of people have is like, would this have been discovered in the limit, or do you think this could have hidden in perpetuity?
I think luck certainly played a role. If I get other releases, I had more of my own work, and like that's often then more like doing code review type stuff, polishing, I don't know, putting the eyes on stuff like that, and not performance work. So I might not have looked at the time. And then if I already had installed, or if the package maintainer had already integrated 5.6.1, I'm not sure I would have figured it out either. And the fact that Valgrind had warned me beforehand, I'm not sure that I would have figured it out without that. And I actually looked back and looked at the report that we got from Valgrind. In hindsight, that would have been enough to figure it out, because there was clearly like some call stacks that were like from underscore start somewhere into the name loader into libLZMA that didn't look right and could have been enough to figure out that the problem was there, but clearly I didn't. And I don't know how many other people had like enough chances to hit this multiple times.
And yeah, interesting.
If I had a fast CPU, like this was a server a CPU, so where the individual cores are a bit slower, and I didn't have Turbo Boost enabled, so like the CPU usage was really exaggerated compared to my laptop, for example, because like that has a faster per core performance, and I'll normally have Turbo Boost enabled or whatever the AMD equivalent is. So that would have been a much shorter spike. So I think there was definitely luck involved. How long it would have not been caught, I go back and forth, I think.
Interesting.
Lots of people, like lots of very high CPU usage in distros that nobody seems to care a whole lot about. Also, SSH is something that I think people are more tuned to being weirded out by. But at the same time, it's also so normal to have all these random probing attacks that everyone, like in a public IP, was from. And I had disabled password authentication, but if I didn't have password authentication disabled, it would have totally been plausible that there some password encryption is taking some time, like running a lot of cycles in bcrypt or whatever, and that would have been a source of the CPU usage or something.
Yeah, interesting.
So I don't think it would have been years, because at some point somebody must have figured it out. But this, on the other hand, like, what if in 5.6.3 or 2 they would have actually optimized the code to only take a few milliseconds? And the story is very different. I'm not sure that would have been statistically found anytime soon. I guess if somebody analyzed actual intrusion, I think that's the most realistic path, is that they started to utilize the backdoor, and then that at some point has to become noisy.
Yeah. So someone begins to see. So have you read The Cuckoo's Egg by Cliff Stoll?
Funnily enough, I saw it referenced a while ago, not weeks ago, and didn't read the original book, but I read about it a few weeks ago.
So it's a great read. And Adam, have you read? I guess we decided that you can't remember if you read The Cuckoo's Egg or not. You and I were talking about this earlier, but The Cuckoo's Egg merits a reread, and in part because that is just as you're saying, Andres, where Cliff Stoll is an astronomer, but is also a computer scientist. And I love his line about the computer scientist thought he wasn't much of a computer scientist, but was a great astronomer. The astronomer thought he wasn't much of an astronomer, but was a great computer scientist. But he's in detecting on the intrusion side, and because the intruder just trips up a little bit. But then he's following his own curiosity. And I think, Andres, this kind of dovetails my next question about how has this whole episode changed you as a technologist?
I think it might have changed me more as a person in the world than as a technologist.
Interesting.
I always thought important to understand the system and bug problems, even though they're not necessarily in my direct NC chain to whatever I need to do. At the same time, I don't think as a technologist there's that much of a change, but it also depends on what you define a technologist as. If I think it does make me change my, has made me change my thoughts about project maintainership a bit, about what the threat model is for being a product maintainer. And news to anybody that has done open source for a while, that we need to do something more about supporting some projects that are very crucial. It made it more apparent. I think it has, whether it has really changed me that much, but what's been very overwhelming in a way is that suddenly school friends called me and said, I read about this. And those school friends have zero connection to tech, and that has never happened in that way.
Right.
And that's really being somewhere in a organization where that is very far outside of what I ever thought I would be in. So I think I wonder whether it is changing me.
Well, I think, but in showing you, at least to me, so I'll tell you that from my perspective, I think that this shines a light on a bunch of different things. I think that one of the things that shines a light on, just strictly positively, is the value of digging into an aberrant system. And this is something that I've always believed strongly in, that when you've got these wisps of smoke, that it's worth it to take the time and really investigate it. And take the no meeting Wednesday or whatever you have, your meeting free day, Andres, and really digging into this stuff, even though it's I've got a deadline and so on. But when you have aberrant behavior in front of you, it may be your last opportunity to really understand that. And I've always kind of thought of that as it's your last opportunity to understand what is just misbehaving software rather than nefarious software. But I can tell you, Andres, that you've already had an impact on me, because I had a very strange bug over the weekend where we did a Rust toolchain update. And it induced an error that it should not have induced. Just the I2C error talking to a serial presence detect on a DIM. And I'm like, and I'd kind of like address the I2C issue, but I'm like, why did the tool chain induce this? And I was listening to some of the podcasts you've been on in terms of talking about this. And I'm like, you know, what would Andres do right now? Andres would like, it's like, it's time to dig into like, what is going on? We got to completely understand this. And ultimately discovered that it's like, yeah, the compiler chain update caused some stack growth, caused a stack overflow and an unrelated thing. And drop a link to the, actually it's all open source. I can drop a link to the ticket in the chat if people are curious on that. But it really was a very like tangible moment of like, I think we engineers need encouragement from one another that it is worth digging into the aberrant behavior. We did the episode with Dave Adam on the CockroachDB data corruption issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that took a long, long time to debug. Obviously not nefarious at all, but very much just in the much more garden variety, but very, a very gnarly data corruption bug. And it, like, engineers need that encouragement that like, no, you should, like, it's a computer. It's supposed to be working the way we designed and you should be investigating this aberrant behavior. And I think, Andres, I got to tell you, I think you're a real inspiration to people who are at that decision point of like, do I investigate this further or not? It's like, Andres would investigate. I think that is, and I think that there's a real potential to be an inspiration to other engineers in that regard.
I'm trying to tee
you up for your speaking tour. You know, I want to be your
book deal. There's a movie here somewhere.
There's definitely a movie. Oh, for sure. We can get a movie.
One thing that has like made me wonder is like, I figured that out if I started later as an engineer, because there's just so many low level systems pieces to this, like knowing how the dynamic linker works. Yeah. And like knowing some performance tools that like really hard to get started with if you start out like at the current complexity rather than at the complexity 20 odd years ago. And worries me a bit like seeing like how much more to learn is these days to get to a very efficient
it's never too late to learn from first principles, I think.
Yeah, I agree. It's just harder, I think, than it used to be.
But I think I'm glad you mentioned the tooling, because you used perf to debug this. Obviously, Valgrind was very important. I mean, our tools are really important to help us understand our software. And it feels like they played an important role here.
Yeah, and like interestingly enough, I had used to use perf, not just the normal perf, but like Intel PT processor trace.
Yeah.
Because it actually, like, normal perf isn't going to be granular enough for this. And the problem was that the profiler, or debugger, didn't reliably work because they have some anti-debugger measures. Yeah. So being able to use that processor trace feature was incredibly powerful. And I've used it like a handful of times before. I'm pretty sure that I'm going to use it more now because it's being able to like see the exact path through a program at very low overhead in execution time, that's really powerful. And I think I was a bit surprised how little tooling is around it.
Well, this, you know, we've discovered this though about a lot of different aspects of DTrace, that sometimes when there are things that are a bit esoteric, but when you need them, you really need them. They're just not as broadly known as you might think. I think they should be. It sounds like this might be an example of that. But obviously critical to help you kind of crack this case and do it relatively quickly.
Back to the question earlier where you said like where they changed me as a technologist. I did think now of something. I think I used to be way more suspicious of like soft security boundaries.
Yeah, okay.
I am now. But I relation that more like things that could give you just like of a heads up that something is going on, the more likely it is that stuff is getting noticed. And given that we realistically want to prevent this kind of attack happening, there's just too many projects and too many interdependencies. Having these kind of security boundaries that were like that aren't individually hard to get over, like add ability for noise, I think that's more powerful than it believed beforehand.
And so, like, what do you mean? Like, what are some of those boundaries concretely?
If, example, that we can tell the linker these days to resolve all the dynamic linker to resolve all symbols at program start, and because of that, we can remap the global offset table read only. Without that, they wouldn't have had to rely on any of this complicated machinery. And distros have started to default to -z now -rel row for a while. And that's fine for long-running programs. It's actually not great for short-running stuff because, like, most of the time, they're not going to use all the dynamic symbols that they're referencing. Yeah. It actually adds overhead to the common case.
Yeah.
If they hadn't had to jump through all these hoops, it wouldn't have been better, I think. So, like, the complexity of providing the overhead of, or defaulting to the overhead of this protection, I was more suspicious beforehand. Now I'm less. And I think there's other kinds of like that, like on the kernel level, doing more. Always a bit annoyed about like mitigation measures that cause CPU overhead because that's I see in profiles often.
I know.
At the same time, I like
know
a bit clear why it's perhaps worth doing that by default.
Yeah, I know, and I feel like on some of these spectrum mitigations in particular, it's like, do we have to like what are we not going to have speculative execution at all anymore? I mean, I know what you mean. There's this. Then what about the someone asked in the chat about FnoImmit frame pointer, which did play a role, a kind of a strange role in this, right? Because can you describe the role that played in the second?
I don't think I understand the backdoor code quickly enough to technically precisely point it, but my understanding is that it assumed a stack layout that would have been the case with without the frame pointer there. And I used that to figure out, like, jump to fish stack, fish information from the stack somewhere further up. Because I was compiling with FnoImmit frame pointer, they accessed the wrong offset. And because of that, there was the Walgreen warning. I've been running my tests with FnoImmit frame pointer just because it makes profiling easier.
I've been doing that
for a while. And like, yes. But it was the reason that it was noticed on Fedora was that they just changed the default to it. So I think that was also made it like easier for somebody else to discover this because like 5.6.6.0 on new Fedoras was suddenly like failing.
Yeah.
What you can see so far, nobody had picked up on that being a problem. Instead, like this warning was silenced, just like I had silenced the warning initially. I think that this perhaps helped figure this out.
Which is great. I mean, I even though I don't like the double negative of NoImmit frame pointer, I definitely,
yes.
I'm very pro frame pointers. And I do think it's interesting, Andres, for people to hear from you that someone who takes performance very seriously and is looking at micro optimizations has frame pointers because it is impossible to understand your software without frame pointers. Please use your frame pointers or you need
I don't necessarily use it for an optimized build. It's noticeable the overhead. I think it's totally worth the overhead by default in most programs. I'm not sure that every program needs to run by frame pointers in an optimized build because like it does make
if you don't have a frame pointer, inline it, which is what Rust does for but I think it's kind of interesting that played a little Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of a role in this kind of FnoImmit frame pointer kind of wandering by having an impact on this story.
Yeah.
Well, Andres, this has been amazing. And we really, really, really appreciate you coming here to, I know you've had a lot. I mean, obviously you're talking to the New York Times, you've got you're a celebrity now, rightfully so. You've got, Satya praising you as he should be. So I know that you've got, and I know you've got a national speaking tour scheduled and you know, with Oprah and, you know, I know you're going to be, So we really, really appreciate you coming here. It's been so great to get your perspective. This is such an extraordinary story in so many different dimensions. And obviously, you know, your role here is a real inspiration to anybody wondering if they should dig into that aberrant behavior, try to understand what's going on. I think you can really serve to inspire other technologists. So thank you very much.
I hope I don't destroy too many hours in a curious.
No, it was great. Thanks everyone for joining us. And then Adam, I know you've got a national championship you need to run to. So we're going to let you do it. Adam is a Connecticut native.
That's right. Big Huskies fan.
Big Huskies fan. Sure. Connecticut having its day because, Connecticut Yankee King Arthur's Court. I always think of whenever there's a total eclipse as there is today. So I feel this is a big Connecticut day and
big day for us nutmeggers. Exactly.
Big day for the nutmeggers. We'll let you get to it. Just a reminder for folks, or actually maybe not a reminder because we may have not publicized the date for the book club discussion. Did I neglect to do
we
that?
We have not. That's right. This is going to be the moment.
All right. So on May 13th, we will be discussing How Life Works hopefully folks have you started to read this or you found the audiobook?
I have started. Started. No, there's no audiobook. I was always planning to read. There is an audiobook available only in the UK, I've discovered. I'm sure folks who need it can pirate it from their UK friends.
I'm really enjoying it. Adam, hope you're enjoying it too. It's definitely, I think it's going to be a totally different direction for a lot of folks. Hopefully in an interesting way. So, that is going to be on May 13th. And we're going to have, my friend Greg Cost is going to join us. He's going to read the book, which is great. He's a microbiologist. And he's like, I got to warn you, like I've read the blurb. This book might be upsetting to me. Is it okay if I'm like, do I have to like the book? I'm like, no, definitely not. Like, that's even better. Like, come in hot. Like, we'll invite Kevin Roos on, treat him as a punching bag as well. Folks, if you haven't started reading that, definitely read that. Join us for the discussion, or you'll be able to obviously catch the recording there. And then I think we've got a wild episode coming up in a week, Adam. I'm going to tease that a little bit. You'll look for more details. We've got a big, big crossover episode coming up next week.
Stay tuned. Yeah. Very exciting.
Stay tuned. I am extremely excited, probably a little too excited for the episode we're going to have next week. Andres, thanks again. Amazing story. Thank you, everyone. Until the next backdoor, take care.